take every precaution to avoid even a hint of influence of political bias or influence.
Controversy over integrity and independence at the USGS. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senate President Pete Kelly wants Medicaid recipients to work or volunteer to receive benefits.
I think it's a valuable thing for someone to work if they're receiving something.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
An Alaskan skier made Olympic history today. Keegan Randall and her teammate from Minnesota, Jesse Diggins, won gold in Pyeongchang in the cross-country team sprint. Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell reports.
The team sprint was the fifth out of six cross-country ski events for the women's team at the Olympics. It was also the best chance for the women to medal for the first time ever at the Winter Games. In the team sprint, two skiers take turns skiing a little over a kilometer around the arena, completing three legs each. And for almost the entire 16-minute race, the Norwegians and the Swedish skiers led, with the Americans tailing behind. Minnesota skier Jesse Diggins anchored for the Americans. Coming up on the last curve of the race, Diggins slips between Norway and pushes up ahead alongside Sweden's Stina Nielsen. She's a ski length behind Nielsen coming into the last stretch. With just a few meters to go, Diggins charges ahead, crossing the finish line just 0.2 of a second ahead of Sweden. Keegan Randall is waiting at the finish and runs out to Diggins, who has collapsed onto the snow. These are Randall's fifth and final Olympics. Randall grew up in Anchorage and skis for Alaska Pacific University. She's won gold a number of times at World Cup races, but going into these games had never medaled at the Olympics. She had her sights set on winning her first at Sochi 4 years ago, but came up short. The Olympic gold medal for Randall and Diggins ends a 46-year drought for the American women. Before Wednesday's race, the team had never medaled at the Winter Games. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Emily Russell.
A report on Alaska's oil potential is at the heart of a controversy at the Department of Interior. The magazine Mother Jones reports that a top scientist at the U.S. Geological Survey resigned late last year to protest what he saw as a threat to the agency's scientific integrity just before USGS released a major assessment of how much oil and gas it believes is in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin has more.
The assessment looked at the oil potential of the Petroleum Reserve, or NPRA, a massive chunk of land on Alaska's North Slope west of Prudhoe Bay. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke announced it just before Christmas in a press release with the headline, "New Interior Department Survey Shows Huge Increase in Recoverable Energy Resources." Huge, in all caps. The USGS is a research arm within the Interior Department. And that breathless announcement, that's definitely not USGS style.
When it comes to doing the quantitative assessments, we take every precaution to avoid even a hint of influence of political bias or influence.
That's David Hausnecht, who wrote the report on the NPRA. Mother Jones reports USGS Associate Director Murray Hitzman resigned on principle after the number two boss at Interior, David Bernhardt, pressed him to release the oil and gas data to the secretary days before it was released to the public. Hitzman did not respond to interview requests for this story, but Mother Jones published his resignation letter. The oil industry and the Trump administration have their eyes on the petroleum reserve as a big opportunity for future development, including areas the Obama administration had put off limits. For years, Hausnecht says, the USGS has made it a practice not to brief political appointees on finished assessments until the moment the document is released publicly. That way, neither side, pro-drilling or anti, gets a head start in putting its spin on the data.
The credibility of the USGS, that's really the most important thing to us.
But Hausnecht says just about every administration in his 25 years with the service has tried to get an early peek at the numbers.
The R's and the D's do that regularly, in my experience, and there's very little difference between the two.
Hausnecht says, as far as he knows, the USGS was not ultimately forced to provide a preview of the data, but then he wasn't at every meeting. A spokeswoman for Interior Secretary Zinke says Zinke and his deputy have the legal authority to see any scientific data produced by the department. She also sent a statement from the USGS director saying the service was not asked to change the assessment at all. Still, the episode has riled conservationists. Adam Colton of the Alaska Wilderness League says it doesn't bode well for the environmental reports that have to be done before any developments in NPRA in the Western Arctic or in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to the east.
We need political appointees to leave the scientists alone at the U.S. Department of Interior. There's work that needs to be done by the Fish and Wildlife Service, by the U.S. Geological Survey, in accordance with the law, and this instills no confidence.
Hausnecht says scientists like him weren't thrilled to see the Interior Department use that all caps huge in its announcement of the NPRA assessment. But he says nothing in the report was changed to suit anyone's political agenda. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Last week, the state's Gasline Corporation got a letter from the federal agency leading the permitting process for the Alaska LNG project. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission says the state agency isn't answering a lot of its questions. Regulators wrote that the state hasn't sent information that is crucial for analyzing the $43 billion project. Rasha McChesney from Alaska's Energy Desk covers the state's Gasline project and joins me now. Rasha, tell me more about this letter. What was in it?
Right. So the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation has been waiting for a response from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission since January. That's when the state corporation announced that it had finished responding to hundreds of questions that the federal agency had asked. In fact, I spoke to Gasline Corporation head Keith Meyer at the time, and he described these 6-foot-high stacks of documents. He was hoping that they'd get a response with a schedule in it, something that would lay out how long it would take for the federal agency to do an environmental review of the project and issue a draft of the permit. But that is not what happened. The Regulatory Commission sent along a 170-page letter with all of these questions that they say need more adequate responses. And they've given the state 20 days to respond.
Okay, so what kind of questions is the Regulatory Commission asking?
These are really specific data requests. Everything from plans the state project has to avoid wildlife and monitor the health of marine mammals to what kind of grass the project will use to revegetate certain areas. The federal agency wants to see a plan for monitoring permafrost and erosion along the pipeline, and they want to see details on how roads will be moved and which private wells that are located near the project will be monitored for contamination. And they want a lot of this information because people who are going to be affected by the project need to have a chance to weigh in on the permit.
Rasha, it seems like a lot of information to compile and get sent off in 20 days. What can you tell us about the lift of this requirement?
Well, I checked in with the Gasline Development Corporation, and what they've told me is that they plan on getting a hold of federal regulators in early March, or at least by early March, and sending them a schedule of how long it's going to take them to answer all of these questions, because a lot of them are going to require really detailed analysis and more field work and things that either haven't been done yet or are going to take a lot of man hours to complete.
Okay. Aren't there also, though, some bigger questions? The Matanuska-Susitna Borough and Valdez have weighed in on the state's project as well. And they're not happy.
Right. So beyond these hyper-specific details about how and where and what impacts construction are going to have in Alaska, the federal agency says the state hasn't done enough studying of alternate routes for the pipeline and the port at the end of it. The Matanuska-Susitna Borough contacted the federal agency in January, and it argued that its Port McKenzie site hadn't been adequately vetted. Borough officials said that ending the pipeline at their port could save billions because the pipeline would be about 50 miles shorter. And Valdez is fighting to get the project moved, too. A group there has been arguing that the pipeline should be rerouted and that Valdez should be the terminal and port. Now, federal regulators are specifically directing the state to study these two sites as alternatives. And this could be a big problem for the state's timeline. Keith Meyer told me last month that the state inherited this route when it took over the project in 2016, but it could take years of additional studying to figure out if these routes are feasible. He says the current route is the one that has to happen in order for the project to get built in time.
What does he mean by that? In time for what?
So there's this window when global natural gas demand is projected to skyrocket. And the idea is to bring the state's gas line project online in time to export to Asia to meet that demand. And the state wants to start construction in 2019. They're trying to build a facility on the North Slope, an 800-mile-long pipeline, and a massive plant in south-central Alaska. And these data requests mean that the state has to spend more time and money doing fieldwork and analysis, and it could affect the project's timeline. There are just a lot of moving pieces that have to fit together for this project to make it to the finish line.
Absolutely, a lot of moving pieces. Have you heard from the state corporation in response to this letter? What are they saying?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, I spoke with them today, and their message is still largely hopeful. I spoke with Jesse Carlstrom. He's a communications manager at the corporation, and he says they're confident that the Federal Commission will have the information it needs to prepare that environmental impact statement this year. So there's definitely not a lot of room for error and a lot of potential delays that are popping up this year.
That was Rasha McChesney with Alaska's Energy Desk speaking to us from Juneau. And a longer version of this interview is at our website, alaskapublic.org/news. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a bill legalizing industrial hemp awaits the governor's signature.
So the hemp seed oil, that would just change everything for us just to, you know, have completely Alaskan grown and made herbs and plants in our products.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kodiak Aleutians Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss possible federal subsistence fish and shellfish proposals and other subsistence-related issues and invites public participation at a meeting February 22nd and 23rd starting at 9 a.m. at the Kodiak Best Western Inn. More at 800-478-1456. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Alaska Senate President Pete Kelly has introduced a bill that would require people who receive Medicaid to work, engage in subsistence activities, or volunteer. But the legislation faces obstacles in the House and is raising concern from those who provide health care to low-income Alaskans. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Kelly, who's a Fairbanks Republican, says the bill he introduced on Monday would help the people who apply for Medicaid.
We think it's beneficial for the people who are receiving this to be able to work or volunteer and just be part of the overall community that produces in Alaska. I think it's a valuable thing for someone to work if they're receiving something.
The bill would affect most Medicaid recipient adults who aren't senior citizens or who have disabilities and can't work. Other people who would be exempt are parents or caretakers of children up to age 6 or who have disabilities, or other relatives who require 24-hour care. Pregnant women also would be exempt. The people who are required to work could fulfill the requirement with at least 20 hours of actively searching for work or engaging in an educational program or training intended to lead to work. If passed, the bill would require the state to seek a waiver from federal Medicaid rules to allow the work requirement. The federal government recently approved similar waivers for Kentucky and Indiana, and 8 other states are seeking work requirement waivers. A lawsuit has been filed seeking to block the Kentucky Work Program. Leading members of the House Majority Caucus aren't in favor of the bill. Slightly more than one in four Alaskans received Medicaid last year. That's slightly above the national average. And the Kaiser Family Foundation estimates nearly three-quarters of Alaska's Medicaid households have at least one full or part-time worker. Juneau Democratic Representative Sam Keto III questions whether hiring state workers to check whether people are complying with work requirements would be worthwhile.
I think we would see quite a bit diminished returns if we actually have to pay general fund money to go out and find out that people are already trying to do the best that they can within their circumstances.
Kelly says he expects the existing state bureaucracy would be able to handle the workload from the bill. The bill has also raised concerns among the people who operate the community health centers that provide health care to lower-income residents. Melody West is the executive director for Sunshine Community Health Center. While she hasn't seen the bill's details, she's concerned about the concept.
My initial reaction would be that it's creating a barrier to care. You're in a rural area. While we're in Talkeetna and Willow, we actually service 12,000 square miles with our health center. And we have over 6,000 patients. And to specifically just, you know, say you have to work, you have to be in some kind of, you know, job program or volunteer, a lot of people don't have that ability to do that.
The bill has been referred to the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
A bill to legalize the production of industrial hemp has made its way through both the State House and Senate and now awaits the governor's signature. If signed into law, the legislation will allow registered participants into a pilot project to grow hemp. That's the name typically used for varieties of the cannabis plant that produce useful fiber, but almost no THC, the psychoactive compound in marijuana that alters people's mental state. Wasilla Republican Senator Shelley Hughes introduced the bill more than a year ago after reworking legislation originally written by former Senator Johnny Ellis.
It was time to remove hemp from the marijuana statutes. There's no psychoactive impact from hemp. If you were to smoke acres and acres and acres of hemp, all you would get would be a sore throat and a cough.
Hughes says she was approached by local farmers in the Matanuska-Susitna borough looking to grow hemp, which can be used as feed and bedding for livestock, as well as material to clean up oil spills. Amber Haynes is one of those interested in growing hemp to supplement livestock feed. But Haynes and her husband also want to grow it for use in products they sell through their Talkeetna-based Silver Bear Sundries.
I just want to use Alaskan hemp.
Right now, Haynes and her husband import hemp from the lower 48 to add to their balms, salves, and other natural body products.
It's been frustrating for us just because our business is entirely made up of products that we wildcraft or grow ourselves. And so the hemp seed oil, that would just change everything for us just to, you know, have completely Alaskan grown and made herbs and plants in our products.
Senator Hughes says she hopes that a pilot project would give the Division of Agriculture a starting point to foster a wider hemp industry in the future. Even if the bill is signed into law soon, Hughes says it's unclear if regulations will be written in time for this year's growing season. She says it's more likely that farmers could be growing industrial hemp in Alaska in 2019. Newly reported court records are raising questions about the personal history of a prominent candidate in the Anchorage mayoral race. Rebecca Logan is challenging incumbent mayor Ethan Berkowitz in this spring's upcoming municipal election. Logan, who is the general manager for the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, has put crime and fiscal issues at the center of her campaign. On Tuesday, KTVA reporter Liz Raines broke a story on Logan's 2010 drunk driving arrest and prolonged financial problems that played out in the courts. According to the KTVA report, that included three different lenders suing Logan for not paying loans between 2006 and 2008. The story suggests Logan used her position as a payroll officer at the time to avoid paying court-ordered wage garnishments. The debts were resolved by 2016. Logan does not deny the issues raised by the report. In a statement on her campaign's Facebook page today, she said her DUI was a powerful lesson that has caused her to make changes. She wrote she's worked hard to fully pay her debts, which she attributes to a difficult divorce and legal challenges to a business sale. and adds that she believes crime is more important to voters than a candidate's personal issues. Anchorage is conducting its first ever municipal election by mail, with ballots arriving to registered voters in mid-March. The last day of voting is April 3rd.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m., only on Alaska Public Media TV.
The CEO and founder of one of the biggest oil companies in Alaska has stepped down. Hillcorp's Jeffrey Hildebrand has handed the reins over to the company's former executive vice president, Greg Lawlicker. A spokesperson from the company's Texas headquarters confirmed the transition, saying in an emailed statement it was announced internally last November. According to state data, Hillcorp is Alaska's third largest oil producer and second largest gas producer. The company is currently pursuing development of the first offshore oil production in federal Arctic waters called the Liberty Project. Hildebrand is known for being among the wealthiest people in the world, with a net worth of $7.6 billion, according to Bloomberg. However, Hildebrand isn't leaving Hillcorp altogether. In a statement, the company says he's staying on as executive chairman and will, quote, continue to be heavily involved with the company. Thousands of Alaskans are on the brink of homelessness each year, including Anchorage resident Dion Nguyen. Alaska Public Media's Solutions Desk is following Dion as he works to keep his home and dreams intact. Reporter Ann Hillman has more.
When Dion Nguyen was unexpectedly hospitalized for more than a month last fall, he realized he was going to have financial difficulties. His medical providers called for backup.
Well, they'd seen what I was going through and the stress that I was having, that I may have to move out of my home. So they said, we think we need to get the social worker in.
Dion wasn't going to be able to return to work anytime soon, and he knew he wouldn't be able to cover all of his expenses. The social worker helped him figure out which programs he could apply for and which he couldn't.
Filled out all that paperwork, and I received it, and they gave me food stamps. They put me on Medicaid, and they let my daughter be on Medicaid, and that's what public assistance did for me.
Though it helped with some things, it wasn't enough to cover his rent. For confidentiality reasons, Dion's social worker couldn't talk to me directly to tell me all of the resources she and other caseworkers tried to access. Instead, she sent me to Anchorage's Aging and Disability Resource Center. It's the first stop for lots of people in the city who are seeking rental assistance.
We get so many requests. We get probably, I want to say, like, each of us probably get like 10 calls a day, maybe, between all three of us.
That's Jasmine Bracey, a resource specialist with the Aging and Disability Resource Center, who focuses on rental assistance. Despite the agency's name, the workers counsel anyone who's trying to find resources in Anchorage. Sometimes, but not always, the ADRC has a small pot of federal money that they can give people for rental assistance. The amount varies from year to year, but HUD provided about $140,000 for rental assistance statewide in 2017. Before they can give money, the resource specialists have to see if the person is eligible. A primary qualification is employment. They have to have worked in the past 30 days for most rental assistance. But what about situations like Dion's, where he couldn't work because of an illness?
I don't really know what would happen, because they wouldn't be able to get assistance if they haven't worked in that last 30 days.
The reason that they have to work is they have to show that they're sustainable.
Jasmine's colleague, Carla Wright, jumps into the conversation. She explains that for most rental assistance programs, a person can only get help once in their life. Unlike some forms of public assistance, it doesn't provide consistent, sustained support.
The whole point in this program is it that someone has hit a speed bump and we're helping them get over that speed bump and that they're going to be able to continue to move forward.
Dion hit a speed bump when he was hospitalized for over a month, had his big toe amputated, and couldn't quickly go back to work. His unique situation disqualified him from receiving some avenues of assistance. That's why Carla and Jasmine look beyond just tapping short-term pots of money and work with people to develop longer-term solutions for maintaining housing. That includes reassessing how they spend their money. They have conversations about budgeting and refer people to financial literacy classes.
When people are writing out their income, it's like, wow, I spend like $700 on just my car or $200 on like a phone bill. So then it kind of lets people see like what they're really spending their money on. So then we get to talking about things like that.
Oftentimes, people develop their own solutions when talking through it all. For Dion, he can't really cut many more expenses. He drives an aging car. Most of his personal belongings fit into a couple rooms. His utilities are included with his rent. Carla says the real key to preventing homelessness for many of the people who are living paycheck to paycheck is to not deny when they're in dire straits.
I think the key is, and we tell people this all the time, is communication. If you know that you're not going to be able to pay your rent, and for whatever reason, instead of waiting for that eviction notice to get put on your door or to be handed to you, go ahead and try to be proactive and go ahead and give us a call before that day, and talk to your landlord.
That's what Dion has been doing since the beginning, trying to be proactive.
When you realized that you were going to be in this situation, what were the first steps you took?
Talking to the landlord. She was supportive of me because she knew what my goal was as far as opening up a foster home, and she was supportive of that.
The landlord is willing to wait while Dion tries to pull together resources, but he still needs help. He can't access federal rental assistance, so he's turning to the next resource Carla and Jasmine often suggest, the faith community. Keep up with Dion's journey at alaskapublic.org/solutions. From the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Emily Russell, Casey Grove, Zachariah Hughes, Ann Hillman, and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
ACPE's Education Loan Refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.